Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Elizabeth H. Schmidt. Schmidt is a former poetry editor for the New York Times Book Review. She edited the acclaimed anthology Poems of New York and also is editor of the newly released The Poets Laureate Anthology, which was published by W.W. Norton in association with the Library of Congress. Elizabeth H. Schmidt teaches American literature at Sarah Lawrence College, and I'm talking to her by phone from her office in New York. Elizabeth H. Schmidt, thank you so much for joining us. Now, before we talk about this beautiful new collection, the Poets Laureate Anthology, I'd like to ask you about how you got interested in poetry.
I think it goes back to really a great high school teacher. That seems to be often the case. I had an amazing teacher of American literature in 10th grade. And I remember vividly the studying of Emily Dickinson's poems in particular in his class. And I fell in love with poetry. I liked especially of Dickinson's poems, I liked the compact form. To me, it was a welcome alternative to reading novels. I remember in particular I wrote a paper on her poem, Because I Could Not Stop for Death. I wrote it and I rewrote it, and I felt like I just got completely lost in the world of that poem. And I remember showing it to my family. This was at boarding school over, I think it was Christmas vacation. And I can remember my father saying, I could have never written anything like that.
Wow, what a compliment, huh?
And I wrote quite a bit of poetry, but I kind of realized that there was something very satisfying, almost in a kind of solving of a riddle or a puzzle in reading poetry, particularly short lyric poems. So that was the exact moment, really. It was 10th grade in high school.
Yeah, I know. I find poetry a magical language, but you really have to like that language because it's kind of mysterious.
You have to like the language, and for, you know, whatever also mysterious reasons, you have to be willing to really slow down. And for me, I loved that at that particular time, and I've loved it ever since. Billy Collins about how poetry, more than anything, gets us to slow down, to stop, to reread, to really, you know, think about the words in our head and the words on the white page in a way that is very, very different from, you know, encountering a page that's full to the brim, margin to margin with prose.
Yeah. Now, I do want to let's talk about the Poets Laureate Anthology. I want to know where this idea for this collection came from. Was there a particular occasion?
Well, you know, I should say that it came from the Library of Congress itself. The Poets Laureate are employed by the Library of Congress. They have their office there. And the director of publications at the Library of Congress had wanted to do this book for a long time. As you know, the Poets Laureate and their various names go all the way back to just after World War II. But the current director of publications had wanted to do this for a while, and I think at some point he wanted to have a poet laureate edit a volume, but they, you know, they're quite busy, and they're usually only at the library for 1 year, at the most two. And I can't quite remember through a number of different ways. I think I had edited poetry at the New York Times Book Review and also worked at the New Yorker. And so we just kind of knew each other and knew people in common. He heard about me and, you know, thought that maybe I would be in for the long haul. And it was a fairly long haul. It was just over 3 years.
Really?
Working on the project. Yeah. I mean, not full time, but, you know, three pretty intense summers. So it was really his idea, and then I had a bunch of my own ideas about how I thought the book should be structured, and it was great to work with the Library of Congress, and it was great that they were kind of open to some new ideas, actually, about the structure of anthologies, which made the project more engaging for me.
You know what I want to ask you, too? I don't know if you know the answer to this, but how does one become a Librarian of Congress?
You're appointed. It's a lifetime appointment, and you're appointed by, you know, by the president.
Really?
So I believe, I mean, I should fact check this. My facts aren't as good on the Librarian of Congress himself, because it's only been men. But I believe Billington was appointed by Reagan and will be there for as long as he likes.
That's interesting. I had no idea how somebody became a librarian.
There haven't been very many. And they generally stay for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. I bet it's a fun job. You have to have a love for literature. That's for sure.
Certainly have to, yeah, you have to have a love for literature and obviously for libraries and library research.
Well, let's talk about the fact that, okay, the first poet laureate was appointed in 1937, and it was through Archibald MacLeach, who was a very well-known poet to most of my listeners, probably. But I didn't know he had been a Librarian of Congress.
Yes, he was. He certainly was. And, you know, and I think they had ideas about how to, because, as you say, he was a wonderful poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had ideas in the various forms, formal ways for poets to actually come in and work at the Library of Congress in advisory roles. You know, and then at one point he decided to really formalize it and choose a, you know, a particular poet from poets who had stood on various committees to be at that point. Well, first it was the chair in poetry. Joseph Auslander was that. And then it became a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress for many years until 1985, I think it was. And mm-hmm. then Robert Penn Warren was the first poet laureate, consultant in poetry, which is usually shortened to just be poet laureate.
Well, the reason why they didn't want to use the word laureate, because they thought it was back to the British.
It has these. I write quite a bit about that in my introduction, my general introduction to the book. Yeah, I mean, it definitely has all sorts of imperial connections that most poets don't want to get near at all, being kind of shackled to the state and being an employee of the state and actually going way back to the earliest time in England, actually being obliged to compose occasional poems for a monarch. So it has this connection to being, you know, kind of in service to some sort of state entity, which is really the opposite of what I think most poets think of when they...
Yeah, well, especially American poets, you know. I can see why American
even contemporary English, but I think all contemporary poets at this point really think of themselves as functioning pretty independently.
Yeah, free spirits. Now, what was the original point of the position? And tell us a little bit about how it might have evolved.
The original point of the position was actually to help them. They were still acquiring books for the library itself, was to first and foremost acquire a great library of poetry for the Library of Congress. And then it evolved into wanting to have a great archive of recordings of poets, recording their work, which really is one of the great things that the Library of Congress has created. So it has a really marvelous archive of just about every poet you can think of reading. So that was a new thing. That was completely something that was created and nurtured and sustained by the consultants in poetry and then the poets laureate consultants in poetry. So that was a big thing. And then at a certain point, it evolved more recently, I think, really with Rita Dove in the early 90s to be what we might think of as a much more activist position.
So sort of an ambassador in some ways, huh?
Yeah, so definitely an ambassador and a public face, a public figure for poetry. But with Rita Dove and Robert Haas and Robert Pinsky, there were a whole series in a row of poets who really brought poetry into prisons and put it out on the internet and made sure that poetry could be distributed to a much, much wider audience, which is, I think, great.
The only obligation they have, though, is to read it at the start and finish of the Library of Congress's reading series, right? They have no other... Huh. That sounds like a kind of a fun job, I must say.
Yeah. It's interesting to see which poets only do that, you know, and continue to just compose as poets, and then which poets really come to Washington and travel all around the country and sometimes the world promoting poetry. It really is the full range of temperaments and styles of people who take the job and do it at very different things, all of which is great.
Do you know if there's any poets who have turned down the position?
Yeah, there are. I heard that Wallace Stevens turned it down. I've heard, and again, none of this is, it's all pretty secret, but this is what I've heard. And then I actually heard more recently that Adrienne Rich has been asked several times and that she turned it down.
Oh, really? Because I was thinking, I wonder why she hasn't been one.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, what I hear is that she's been asked and it wasn't, you know, the right time for her to do it, or she didn't believe, who knows why she hasn't made any public statement about it.
That's fascinating to me, too. Now, how do they go about choosing the laureates? Does somebody give them a list?
I actually don't know. That's pretty secret. It's only announced. by the Librarian of Congress. That's really all we know.
So you don't know if they're
not... Certainly has a lot of advisors because he makes very good decisions, but it really is his choice and his announcement.
Huh, so you don't even know if anybody nominates secretly or anything, huh?
Yeah, nothing's made public, don't know.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about the book itself. How did you go about choosing the poems? I know each poet has a signature poem that you've included, but beyond that, how did you choose the small body of work that you presented?
Well, I had several ways. I mean, one is I certainly went back and read every poem by each of the poets, so I just had a stack of books. And I read first for, you know, my favorite poems, for the most striking poems, and so those always went into one pile. I was very interested in if there were poems that I thought in some way commented on any kind of political situation, since it is a public post in many ways, and it is indeed, by definition, a political post.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked for poems, you know, that had something to do with major political event of the time, if that existed, or there's several poems that have been written to presidents. Those were all less well-known poems by each of the poets, but I wanted to make sure to include those if I felt they were, on their own, of course, enjoyable to read. And then I wanted to have a range of both what we might think of as the greatest hits by a particular poet, which I know very well. So mm-hmm. There are poems by Robert Frost, The Mending Wall, and The Gift Outright, Elizabeth Bishop's At the Fish Houses, and One Art, you know, so many William Carlos Williams's Red Wheelbarrow, I mean, poems that have been anthologized everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make sure that there were kind of these touchstone poems that readers could say, oh, yes, 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 of course I know this, but I also wanted there to be what I would think of as surprises.
And there were, I must tell you, because a lot of the poets I'm familiar with, and there were some works in there that I had not seen. Very interesting.
That was important to me, and I had wonderful groups of readers who I was running things by as well. That was pretty much the process of looking at the best-known poems and making sure that I got a number of those, looking at poems that, again, might be some of the new poems for you, maybe poems that also do have some sort of what I would, you know, again, call widely a political, mm-hmm. you know, poem in some way. And then, you know, and I also wanted to make sure there were a number of, like, short lyrics. The book is designed so that readers certainly don't have to read it from start to finish, can dip in and move about. So I wanted to make sure that there were a number of poems of different lengths, short, wonderful lyrics, but also there are a number of longer poems for times when you really just want to sit down and spend a good half hour, 45 minutes reading one poem as it develops.
Well, you know, I was wondering also with the poets that are still living, did you consult with them at all?
Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. I mean, on the whole, I did not. On the whole, I made the selection, and of course they had to give permission, so they were certainly aware of the selection themselves, but no, on the whole, you know, everyone seemed to be pretty happy with their selection.
Uh-huh. Did you find any surprises in your own experience that you had never uncovered about a poet?
So many surprises. Wonderful. It's almost a continuous process of discovery. So on the largest sense, there were poets whose work I really didn't know as well, like Josephine Jacobs, who I now am a huge fan of. And then even within a particular poet's work, a poet I thought I knew so well, like Robert Haas, for example, when I went back and read his books from the beginning, I loved his early works, and I actually wasn't as familiar with some of his works from his first book, Praise, for example. I felt like for his work, I got a much stronger sense of his overall arc when I had been much more familiar with the work he'd published, actually around the time that he was Poet Laureate.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a similar situation with Rita Dove, whose work I love. There are a number of poems from her first book in there that, for me, again, were a discovery, because I was more familiar with the work that was being published in periodicals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elizabeth H. Schmidt. We're talking about a collection of poetry that she just recently edited. It's called The Poets Laureate Anthology. It's in collaboration with the Library of Congress and W.W. Norton. I want to bring this up to you. I know this doesn't have anything to do with you, but I do find it dispiriting that in the 43 Poets Laureate to date that we have in this country, none have been Latino or Latina, none have been Asian. Is that a bone of contention?
Yeah, it is dispiriting. I myself hope that changes. In fact, actually, William Carlos Williams' mother, I believe, is of Puerto Rican descent, so that was corrected for me in that particular. So he is of Latino heritage, but everything else still stands. It would be nice if there could be a slightly more diverse group of poets in the future.
Yeah, and I was thinking that people might call for an openly gay or lesbian poet, too.
I think Kay Ryan would
qualify
as that, and I do talk about that, I think, a little bit in her introduction, yeah.
That's right.
I think that's been covered maybe better than some other things.
Uh-huh. Now, I want to bring something up. You wrote something really interesting in your introduction, and you said, pragmatically speaking, a poet's very vocation, whether she or he winds up as laureled or not, can be seen as a declaration of independence. I thought that was an interesting line. Tell us what you were meaning by that.
Right. Well, and I think in that particular moment, I think I was talking about financial independence, that a poet will always have to find other, will never make, you know, any kind of living, really, by writing poetry itself, because it's just unlike the occasional novel that can get a great advance, or certainly a nonfiction book for which, you know, you get even larger advances. You know, poetry is not something, it's not a writing vocation that you choose in order to make a living. You know, if you're successful, eventually you can get a good, probably a good teaching job. But you choose it because, you know, you love it and it's an art form that you do, but you pursue it in an utterly independent realm from daily life or, again, even politics, which was always an interesting question with this book.
Yeah, I you know, when I read that line, I thought you meant a declaration of independence in regard to intellectualism.
Well,
you know what
I
mean?
I think, yeah, sure. I think it is that because I think, you know, the lyric poets are, you know, very much live in their head as much as they know their predecessors' work and the people who are writing currently. But I really do think you compose more often, at least the very act of composing is much more independent and in isolation than even other forms of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is independent in that way.
Yeah, I think the language of poetry in some ways is sort of rebellious.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then there are great, like, whole schools of poetry that are defined by having, you know, a rebellious tone and streak and even, like, reason for being.
I wanted to ask you this, too. Did you ever write poetry? I see in your biography.
I do write some. I've worked much more as an editor and as a scholar, but I definitely do write poetry. And, in fact, the process of writing this book, I think just reading so much poetry got me writing more of it. So that's something I'm actually doing more now than I have in the past.
Oh, so it inspired you as well. Now,
yeah, I think the immersion in language in poetic language can sometimes have that effect.
Uh-huh. You know what I loved about this collection, too? I discovered poets like Mark Strand that I had totally forgotten about. You know, somebody I had just read occasionally, and his stuff is so gorgeous and still
gorgeous.
It holds up, and it's so much to do with real life and real emotions.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that.
Yeah.
Mark Strand would be delighted, too. That's wonderful to hear. I mean, that's certainly, in a way, the point of a book like this.
Yeah,
put back the public attention you might not be familiar with.
Yeah, tell us too about some of the poets that have touched your life personally besides Emily Dickinson.
Well, I love Elizabeth Bishop. You know, I think her work is absolutely incredible, and I actually ended up, you know, writing my undergraduate thesis on her and spending a lot of time in the Vassar archives, which had just become public. So I love the way that she writes about childhood memory and how that's transformed in many of her most vivid poems. She has something, she actually was a close friend of Mark Strand's. You just mentioned one of the things they have in common is they're both trained as painters.
Mm.
And so they have this incredible visual sense. Bishop's is a little bit more having to do with watercolors, actually, and formal arrangements. And Strand is very influenced by, I think, Edward Hopper. And he actually wrote a small book about Hopper at one point. So they have, you know, different styles in their work, but they both have a very painterly, you know, very vivid visual imagery and descriptions in their work.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I think that's what I loved about Mark Strand, because I'm a total fan of Hopper as well.
Oh, yeah, really? Well,
absolutely. Yeah. Now, I want to talk a
that
little
makes
bit.
Sense.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about you personally. You have written book reviews throughout your whole career. Is it difficult for you to judge people's work in the early stages before the public's even had a chance to read it? Book reviewers have such power.
You know what? It is difficult. You know, but I have to say, I'm not. I don't generally take assignments if I don't like the work. So
oh,
I
really?
Put that out there. So I'm a kind of particular kind of book critic. You know, I can become quite analytical about something if I don't love it. So I don't obviously always, you know, write raves, but particularly actually of a young writer. That's actually not interesting to me, you know, to take a writer's career and, you know, trash it.
Mm-hmm.
No, so I don't do that. I feel like there's so many books being still, thank goodness, being written, and there's so few venues for those books to get any kind of attention. I really can't think of any review where I've said, you know, where I said something, you know, really negative, or I felt that for whatever reason the work hasn't, that the writer should not continue. I've felt that when I've been given a galley or two to read, and I just haven't taken the assignment.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you think the mission of the book reviewer is? To enlighten the reader?
I know. I'm pretty clear about that, or at least when I do it. I think it's really to convey to the reader a sense of the book so that the reader can make a choice and to give a little bit of guidance about where maybe to place that work critically or in some kind of continuum. But I feel like, you know, reviewers should always quote amply from the book so that readers can get a sense of what the writer's voice is actually like. You know, that comes from my interest in poetry and really how the voice sounds on the page. And never, if I'm doing novels, never give away plot. That's actually sort of a fun challenge in writing a review, is to convey a sense of the book's theme and themes and where it goes, but never to give anything away. And I personally like, and I found that, you know, that at least in reviews, it's really nice to get a tiny bit of a sense of where the author, who the author is, where the author's coming from, if it's an early work or a late work. So to place the work, you know, either within the author's lifetime, if they're an established writer, or, you know, if it's a debut, give a little bit of sense of where the author, how old the author is, where she's coming from, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance, both as a reviewer and doing this current book, to get to know some of the contemporary writers on a personal basis?
I knew some of them already before. I've either worked with them as teachers or has worked with them at periodicals where I edited, so I do happen to know some of the poets, many of the poets. I mean, not very well, but I know them as people.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also teach American literature. Is that true at Sarah Lawrence College?
I do, although I should say my biography's changed a tiny bit just this semester, just since January. I've actually started to do work in charter schools in New York, so I'm training teachers to teach writing, poetry, and the humanities in general to help enrich the curricula of a number of really great charter school networks in and around New York.
Uh-huh.
So I've shifted. It's an interesting shift.
That is. Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think the state of American literature is these days?
I think it's okay. I'd like to get to students earlier, and that's part of why I'm doing this. And I'd like to, you know, I'd like for students from more diverse backgrounds to encounter what I would call, you know, kind of serious literature earlier.
Mm-hmm. What ages are you working with right now?
I'm actually working with programming for middle schools and high schools. So I'm going back to the earliest. I think fifth grade is actually a great age to really bring students challenging writing, if they've, you know, if their literacy skills are obviously strong already.
Well, I was going to ask you that, too, because I've known a lot of teachers here in the Finger Lakes area, and a lot of teachers are worried about the state of kids' literacy.
Yeah, I know.
Are you finding that, too? Or?
Yes, I'm finding it, and frankly, I was finding it in college.
Really?
You know, with my first-year students just coming in without the kind of reading skills that I would hope they would have, and certainly without the breadth of knowledge that I would hope they would have. So that's also part of why I thought, well, let's go back a little bit earlier and see what can be done building up towards college.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to kind of push back a little bit against the absolute bombardment that young kids are experiencing now with,
video games and
video games, new media, you know. texting, all that kind of stuff, movies, you know. It's a very
distracting culture.
Growing up in a, visual culture, you know, distracting visual culture, short attention spurts. So I'm hoping I can help a little bit in working with this with students in an earlier age.
Betsy, we only have about a minute and a half left. I want to ask you this Poets Laureate anthology. Well, what do you hope to accomplish with it? Turn more people onto poetry?
Just exactly what you said. I hope people discover poets like you said, Mark Strand. You know, that they may have heard their names or read them a long time ago, but they're reading them again. And, you know, I hope that they can experience some of the range of what's available and what American poets, so, as well as the scope, you know, going all the way back to World War II. I think these are some of our greatest voices, and I think there's a wonderful variety. There's something in here, I think, for just about everyone. So I hope people are drawn by one thing, but then end up discovering something new.
Yeah, they're really the voices of our culture and our history, which to me is quite enchanting. Well,
yeah.
Elizabeth H. Schmidt, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called The Poets Laureate Anthology, published by W.W. Norton in association with the Library of Congress. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.